Sid died. We've been friends, more like brothers, since 1960. There are a lot of stories about those years, and that, a love of stories, is one of the best things he gave me. He always had a story about this or that, and whenever we were talking, I'd try my hardest to keep up. What else? Adventure. It was Sid who pushed my ideas of what was possible in the wild. He was often the driving force behind some trip up some mountain somewhere. The stories here I'm about to tell are about Sid, who he was, what he was like, and maybe who we were. We'd been there for each other since those earliest days. It started with Boy Scouts. The Jamboree. Sid and I met at the 1960 Boy Scout Jamboree in Colorado Springs, Colorado. For a jamboree, they make up troops from a town by taking a few scouts from each of the various local troops. Sid and I were in different home troops, but both wound up in the Levittown Jamboree troop. Sid was made a patrol leader, and I was in his patrol. Mr. Madden was our jamboree scoutmaster. Neversink was the name of our jamboree troop. We all got on a train and headed from Long Island out to Colorado Springs. Now, Mr. Madden considered himself something of a military drill sergeant and asserted his discipline over the troop. He had us practicing marching, which he thought was important, and made it clear he was in charge. He decreed that nobody could explore the Jamboree until we had the Neversink campsite in order. This meant putting up the gateway we'd brought for our campsite. It had two thick poles that would hold up the Neversink sign we'd brought. Now, the ground was really hard and dry. We needed to dig fairly deep holes for those poles. The shovels we had were not up to the task. We needed a post hole digger and asked if we could go borrow one from another troop. "Nobody leaves until the gateway is up," he said. We explained we couldn't get the gate up without a post hole digger. Proud of the strict discipline he was teaching us, Mr. Madden reiterated, "Nobody leaves until the gateway is up." The jamboree went on for, I think, 5 days. Our whole troop missed the first 2 days because we were confined to the camp because we couldn't dig the holes for the posts. Finally, a couple of kids snuck out of camp, borrowed a post hole digger, dug the holes, and returned the digger without Madden, no longer deserving the respect of Mr., knowing it. We were now free to enjoy the jamboree. Why is this story important? It was to be a repeating theme in much of Sid's life. Sid would work hard to earn something, deserve something, and then get denied by some force such as Madden. Here Sid was, selected for the jamboree, a real honor for a scout, only to wind up confined to camp for the first 2 days. He'd often find himself having to fight a second time to claim what was his. Sometimes he'd win, sometimes he'd lost. Why else was it important? More than anger, we were amused by the absurdity of it all. Both Sid and I could step out of the scene and just laugh. At that jamboree, I got a reputation for laughing till the tears streamed down my face. This was the seed that led to our appreciation of the existential humor of a play like Waiting for Godot. More on that later. We did enjoy the rest of the jamboree, and it was the beginning of the connection between Sid and myself. For me, I'd never met anyone like Sid before. He knew how to get stuff done. He knew what had to be done. He knew how to do it, like our patrol's area. He was getting the tents organized, the cooking area, the top tarp over the picnic table, all that stuff. He was just a whirlwind of energy, making everything that needed to happen, happen. The rest of us were just sitting around watching. Sid got up on his high horse and got mad and started lecturing us, saying how he was doing all this work to get things ready, and we were just sitting around not doing anything. I don't know what inspired me. I think maybe partly a sense of awe at watching him, but I said, "You enjoy doing the work. We don't." He was just dumbfounded. I was right. He was in his element. He didn't know how to respond, and I think it was maybe at that moment we developed an understanding and a friendship that lasted all those years. Acrophobia and rock climbing. I learned about Sid's acrophobia, fear of heights, at that jamboree. Everything was flat. but we took a trip to the Garden of Gods. There was a not very high rock with a railing around it called Steamboat Rock, with broad steps leading up to the top. The steps were wide and there was a railing in the middle as well as on both sides. Sid was afraid. We didn't understand. It wasn't very high. The steps weren't steep and there were railings, yet there he was, terrified. We, of course, knew nothing of phobias, were insensitive to his plight, and pushed and goaded him to go up the stairs. He made it up to the center of the flat area and was just shaking with fear. He couldn't handle it. He grabbed that railing in the center, a good 5 feet from the railings on either side, and edged his way back down, pleading with us to understand. I couldn't believe how tight he gripped that rail. I'd never seen anyone so afraid of something. We knew then maybe we shouldn't have pushed him so hard. Rock climbing. Jump forward to our college years, and we had both discovered our college outing clubs, a natural place for ex-Boy Scouts to wind up. Sid got into whitewater canoeing, I got into rock climbing, and witnessed Sid do something remarkable. Sid decided he didn't want his acrophobia controlling his life. He asked me to help him become a rock climber. He took it slow. The first thing he did was simply go to a climbing area. It was a friendly area with a wide road along the base of the cliffs, and where we were, the cliff wasn't very high, maybe 50 or 60 feet. He wouldn't even get close to the cliff. On his third trip, he got up to the cliff. On the next trip, he tied a rope around his waist and took one move up and then back down. I belayed him and made sure the rope was tight. Eventually, with a tight rope belaying him, he made it to the top of the cliff. I was amazed. I'd never seen anyone have such determination to overcome an internal demon like that. From there, we went on to taller cliffs and climbing on the granite mountains of the Tetons. That fear was still there for him, the reactions were still there, but Sid, goddammit, wasn't going to let that stop him. We were going to climb those mountains, and so we did. Whitewater canoe races. While I was rock climbing, Sid was engaged in competitive whitewater slalom canoeing. Just as I led him up rock climbs, he got me in boat and paddling. I competed in a couple of races in the novice class. It was a blast. It wasn't too long ago that I read something on male bonding. It said the most likely way for it to happen is when two men are each good in separate fields rather than the same one. Well, how about that? That was us. We used to compete at everything, but not in either of these areas. He was the paddler. I was the climber. The pattern of earning something and then being denied happened in canoeing for Sid as well. After earning a place on the national team for the international championships as the fourth boat, they decided to only send three boats. He'd call me up and tell me these stories, and it was a strange mix of outrage, anger, but acceptance and humor. He'd say, "You can't believe what they did." It happened so often, it was almost as if he wouldn't be comfortable if it didn't happen. As always, he'd just pick himself up and continue the fight. He got his rightful position on the national team and went to paddle in the internationals in Italy in a following year. Levittown. Now let me step back in the story a bit, to Levittown, where we grew up. We spent a lot of time together after that jamboree, even though it required our parents to drive us. It was maybe another incident of someone in authority messing Sid up that made us even closer. Sid was on his high school soccer team. After running into another kid, Sid was on the ground and pretty sure he had broken his leg. The coach told him to get up. He said his leg was broken. The coach ridiculed him. Said, "No, you haven't. Just stand up and get back in the game." So Sid stood up, and a simple fracture turned into a compound one as the bone popped through the skin and he fell back down. That meant Sid was confined to his house for a long time, so I'd just go over to hang out with him. We played a lot of chess. It was annoying how good he was, because I was the brainiac of the two of us, and it made no sense that he could play so well. But he was so competitive. We both were. Sid's intelligence also showed in his aptitude for analyzing sports. He could break some sports action down and see it differently and how to do it better. In the summers, he'd come over to our house where we played a lot of croquet. There are two ways to hit a croquet ball. One was like a golf swing, which provided power but was difficult to aim. The other was standing over the ball and using a pendulum stroke, which was accurate, but what with your body in the way, hard to get much power. Sid, after just a little time playing, decided on making a third way. He used the straddle technique for accuracy, but then stood backwards, looking between his legs, and then took a big swing. I was upset. That's just not how you do it. He said, why not? And kept doing it, and kept winning. This also was a theme in his life. He just had an eye for sports and athletic movement. I believe his articles on how to set up a women's volleyball team based on the skills of the team is still a classic in volleyball circles. He just had a different way of looking at things. Coaching. Sid was a gifted coach. We were wandering around Cambridge, Mass. One day. I don't remember why, but we came across some people playing a game we hadn't seen before. It turns out it was, I think, Australian rules football. Sort of like rugby, but different. We'd been watching only a few minutes, and Sid starts commenting on how this player on the other side was out of position and where he needed to be to more effectively do whatever it was he was doing. I mean, Sid just saw that stuff. I mentioned he took me and my wife at the time, Anne, canoeing. It was New England in the 1970s, and in the winter, the canoers would practice indoors with slalom competitions set up in swimming pools. Gates were hung over the pool, just like in a whitewater slalom race, and just like in such a competition, the paddlers had to take a path through the gates, some forward, some backwards, different turns to get to them, like that. Well, I knew a fair amount about canoeing, but not racing, and Anne didn't really know anything. So I, being the man and all, and the experienced paddler, would be paddling the stern, with Anne in the bow. Sid had a different idea. He told me to get in the bow and let Anne paddle stern. I was a bit put off, but Sid said, no, listen, the bow is where you get the power for this type of race. You provide the power and let Anne just steer through the gates. Well, no other man-woman pair in the canoes paddled that way. But, okay, I was still pissed and decided to do it and decided to prove Sid wrong. I got in the front and didn't even try to control the heading of the boat. I just paddled as hard as I could and waited for Anne to bump into gates or something and ruin the whole run. She didn't. We won. Sid was like that. He saw a better way to use our assets to win that particular type of race. Jewishness. Sid, by his own admission, might best be described as an obnoxious Brooklyn Jew. He and his family were from Brooklyn, but for some reason I never understood, had moved to Levittown for a few years. They then moved back, and he graduated from high school in Brooklyn, but not until I'd visited a bunch and got to play stickball in Brooklyn streets and stoop ball. In Levittown, where we were, there was a fairly large Jewish population, and true to stereotype, they all cared about public education, so at least half of the kids in the advanced classes in school were Jewish. Most of my friends were Jewish. More than one of my friend's mothers made me an honorary Jew. Sid's mother was one of them. She liked me better than Sid, and Sid knew it. It was okay, though. My dad liked Sid better than me. Central High, Providence, Rhode Island. I was going to school at Brown in Providence, and Sid was teaching at Central High in Providence. It was a tough, mostly black, inner-city school. He taught history and social studies. He'd sent two girls to detention. They both complained to the principal that that was done because Sid was a racist. The school wanted no part of that, so they started proceedings against him. Sid decided, in his defense, to ask his students to write an essay on whether or not Mr. Feldman was racist. One said he was a racist, but it's not the blacks he doesn't like, it's the Jews. He got overwhelming support from his students. This was a theme in his life as well. Students, players who really appreciate what he had done for them. It wasn't a well-funded school, and he had to share his classroom with his biology teacher. She was a black woman and often had to set up demonstrations for her class in the back while Sid teaching his lessons. Now word of this Jewish racist teacher had reached an activist black minister, and he was on the way to the school. It turns out his wife was that biology teacher. She didn't know what was going on, but went outside to meet her husband coming to the school. She asked him why he was visiting. He explained he was there to investigate reports of a racist teacher. She said, "Really? Who?" He said, "Sid Feldman." She said, "You have to be kidding. He's the only teacher in this school doing anything for us." There he was, doing great work, teaching in the inner city, and being thrown over by administrators. And he fought it, and won. A theme. Other good work he did at that school? There was a drama competition. Sid and I had both gotten totally into the existential writing of Samuel Beckett, and in particular his play Waiting for Godot. It's just two characters on stage, talking, waiting. Godot, of course, never shows up. It's an absurd view of meaningless life. While the other schools in the competition put on the sorts of happy shows they might put on, Sid got a couple of these inner-city black kids to do Waiting for Godot. He said they totally understood the play and performed it perfectly, capturing all its existential angst. The audience was stunned for about 5 minutes before bursting into applause. They didn't win. Golf. In my senior year of college, my girlfriend got pregnant, so I settled down to be married. Sid, who was a year ahead of me, had joined the Peace Corps after graduating. Well, things went wrong for both of us. There were problems in the Peace Corps, and Sid came back early and pretty distraught. My young marriage had just failed, leaving me distraught as well. He'd come to visit, and we were hanging out in my empty apartment, both really down, both having told each other our long tales of woe. We were sitting there with our heads hung low when at the same moment we both sat up, looked at each other, and at the same time said, "Golf." Understand that this was the 1960s and we were into all sorts of counterculture sort of activities like climbing and canoeing and camping. Golf to us and those of our ilk was an establishment pastime. But we had dabbled with it in our teenage years and were amused at the fact that golf is, as a game, more than a little bit absurd. Just right for the two of us at just that moment, so we went out and played. This was the start of our decades-long competition. Yup, decades. And we kept score by decades. I was better during our 10s, 20s, and 30s. He was better in our 40s, 50s, and 60s. We tied in our 70s. Keeping score was part of our golf culture. It wasn't just a simple score. We'd play, and then the real competition would begin, the debate about who won the essence of the game. Golf is full of opportunities for that, like does stroke play, total score, or match play, total holes won, better capture who played better. It was worse than that. Sid had his own demons and wanted to win and wanted to convince himself he deserved to win, so he'd keep score both ways. There's more. For men, golf is really about driving. So apart from the score, who was driving the ball better? If Sid won the game but felt I was driving better, he'd feel he lost. And then there's the question of who had the best hole. So many ways to evaluate a game. So you can see, debating who really won was really the essence of the competition. Did we enjoy that more than the game itself? Maybe. We did finally agree on a scoring system after a particularly tough day in drizzling rain. We were playing match play, but on this one long par five, we were struggling. What with tee shots into the woods, penalty strokes coming out, flubbed shots on the fairway, because the grips were wet, really. Neither Sid nor I had a clear idea of where we stood in that all-important stroke count on that hole. We were only halfway to the green and arguing. No, no, you went into the woods. But after you dropped, you flubbed it. No, and it went back into the woods. So that's seven, and then you... Did I mention our appreciation of the absurdity of life? We often laughed at the image of the two of us in the drizzling rain, only halfway to the green, arguing about whether we'd had 11 or 12 strokes to that point. Anyway, this did lead to the creation of our own official scoring method. Match play, each hole is its own small game, but modified for our sometimes abysmal play. You could only win a hole with a legal, we didn't always honor the real rules, double bogey. So if we both sucked on a hole, we didn't need an accurate score. It was zero for both of us. 17th hole at PGA Sawgrass. Did that fix our scoring debates? Not really. And here is the most famous one. Harriet, what an amazingly good woman she is, said that Sid and I needed to have a golf outing to a famous course. Did she even pay for it for us? I don't remember, but maybe. But it was her who got us going. She set it up for us, and we went to Florida to play 2 days at PGA Sawgrass in Florida. That's where they have the Players' Championship each year. Its 17th hole is famous and the signature hole of the course. It's a par 3, and the green is on an island in the middle of a lake. There's a narrow causeway to get out to putt. As we got to the course, Sid said, "You know, it doesn't really matter what the score is. It's whoever gets on 17 will be the winner." I swear he said that. He never explicitly denied it. Just joking? Well, you've heard how we keep score. The first day, I hit my tee shot onto the green and two-putted for a par 3. He hit his in the lake. The second day, I hit my tee shot onto the green and two-putted for a par 3. He hit his first ball into the water, then put a second shot from the tee onto the green and sank the putt. That's two tee shots, one penalty for the water, and one putt for a 4. And so our weekend ends. Sid notes that he outscored me in stroke play both days. He notes that he beat me in match play both days. He notes that he was in general driving the ball better than me both days. And he notes that his birdie, one under par, on the very difficult 18th hole, was maybe the best play of the weekend. All of that was easily true. But I had hit the island 17th green both days, and parred both days. So I claimed I won. He said his second day hitting the green and one putting was better. I said that was a great shot and putt, but still his first ball went in the lake. Mine didn't. I won. I don't remember how long it was ago that we played there, but the debate continued through the decades. Just a week before he died, in a bunch of things he said, was the claim that he had won at that 17th hole. I didn't contradict him. An eating competition. Now, Sid ate faster than anyone I ever met, and I've never met anyone who eats slower than me. But we were competitive, and I like a challenge, so I decided to beat him in an eating race. The venue was a small dinner party with Sid and maybe 4 or 5 other friends. My wife, Ann, had made a nice chicken dinner for us all. Now, the only way for me to beat Sid in an eating race was, 1, not to tell him it's a race, and 2, to cheat. I was ready. When it was time to eat, I made sure I got to the stove first, got my chicken and other stuff on my plate, and sat down before the others. I didn't say anything. I just immediately started shoving food in my face as others were still getting theirs. Finally, Sid had his plate and sat at the table. As soon as he sat, I looked up for a second and said, "Sid, how's your canoeing season going?" and immediately lowered my head back to my plate. The whole time I was focused just on eating, I could hear Sid talking nonstop. I finally finished and was ready to savor my victory and looked over at him, still going on and on about canoeing, with his plate in front of him. And on it were some chicken bones, picked perfectly clean. I don't know how he did it. I did, in all fairness, tell him of the competition he'd just won after the fact. University of Georgia volleyball program. A dark chapter in Sid's life was his firing from UGA. It followed the pattern of him following the rules, doing really well, and then getting screwed. There he was, a Brooklyn Jew, building the women's volleyball program at the University of Georgia. What could go wrong? Nothing at first. He built a team with players that have remembered him forever. And let's cut to the bottom line of college sports. 1-2 Southeast SEC championships. He was rolling. Now, he won those championships, making good coaching decisions and playing his best players. But there was one girl who thought she should be first string, who was really mad she wasn't, and more important, whose influential father also thought she should be first string. She accused Sid of not anything in particular, but just being sexually inappropriate. The athletic director didn't want this sort of scandal and fired Sid. It's not so much the girl accusing him that bothered him, it did, but that athletic director who refused to stand behind him. It's the same story from the Jamboree Scoutmaster, the soccer coach, the national canoeing team coach, the high school principal. Sid bounced back from those other setbacks. He fought them and won, but they were smaller. This was his career, and he lost his appeals to that Southern athletic director. I talked to Sid a lot in the years after that. The humor and absurdity part of his reactions wasn't there. He didn't see anything funny in this one. That girl and athletic director had taken his life away. It was sad for me to see him sink into a shell for a number of years. He then taught high school, and eventually he got his mojo back and returned to women's volleyball. He became head coach at Piedmont College, close to where he and Harriet had a Georgia Mountains cabin getaway, and where he had a number of good years with winning season and players who appreciated all he taught them. Do you wonder if maybe he did something wrong at UGA? He taught and coached his entire adult life, and this was the only time he'd been accused of anything like this, other than that racism story told earlier. Not only that, the player had transferred to UGA from another school, where she had done the same thing. After not making first string and disappointing her father, she accused the coach and got him fired. Sid did not have a sense of humor about that girl or the athletic director. Harriet. Harriet, what can I say? I'm so glad they found each other. Sid and I enjoyed our times together, adventures in our younger years, golf in our middle years, and we were always in touch to some degree or other. But Harriet added something. It was just a pleasure to be with them both, to sense their connection, their shared humor and wit. Harriet, also a teacher like Sid, was every bit Sid's equal with comments like, "The kids today don't need self-esteem. I don't have self-esteem, and I do okay. What these kids need is to do their homework." I only visited him once in this last year, but there he was, lying in his hospital bed, pushed next to their bed. Harriet was just lounging on the larger bed, propped up on one elbow, comfortable, relaxed, and leaning towards Sid. And Sid was talking about something, and I was in the conversation, and Harriet was just there, so much a part of him. Of course, because we talked about everything, I talked with Sid about it later, and he said how much he was enjoying it, just him and Harriet lying on the beds, watching TV, commenting on the shows, making fun of this person, pontificating about that topic. She brought a joy into his life over that last year that spilled over into all my long talks with him. Thanks, Harriet. Hospice. Sid almost died last summer, but he didn't. They saved him, and he wound up confined to a hospital bed in his home. His care changed to hospice, not the sort of hospice where one is waiting to die, but rather a hospice where they stopped doing medical procedures and tests. Sid loved it. No more hours spent on doctor's visits. But when I say confined, I mean confined. He couldn't even get to the bathroom, and rolling over made him out of breath. Yet when I talked with him on the phone, as we often did in those last months, he was still Sid, still fun, his mind and wit as sharp as always. We'd talk about the fears and uncertainties of current politics, the corruption of college football, and his own reduction to a Godot-like existence. How did he deal with these things? With a full embracing of the absurdity of it all, with reactions of anger, sarcasm, and laughter. just as we had reacted to being absurdly confined to camp at that Boy Scout Jamboree so many years ago.
Dennis, you weren't supposed to send a second-rate team up here to challenge us. We're going to lose several million dollars because you're going to keep us out of the championship. Goddamn UMass. They made a lot of mistakes, like changing their coach on Monday. They changed their coach. I mean, we're dying down here. We're absolutely dying.